Welcome to The Other Hand, a podcast brought to you by CJP Economics, a collaboration between Jim Power and Chris Johns, where we discuss the intersection between politics, finance, and economics. Our back catalogue of podcasts can be found at our Substack website, and that Substack site also contains our extensive body of written work. Thanks for listening and reading. If you like our work, please share with your friends and sign up to our newsletter. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of The Other Hand podcast. My guest today is Professor Chris Gray. He will be known to many in Ireland and elsewhere, of course. Based in Cambridge, Chris became known to many of us as a blogger, particularly in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum. So rather than do the formal readout, his bio and all that kind of stuff that often happens in these things, I'm going to ask Chris to introduce himself, and in particular to perhaps elaborate briefly on the circumstances that led to him actually launching that very famous blog.
Hello, Chris. Thanks ever so much for inviting me to talk to you and to talk to your listeners. How do I introduce myself? I mean, very briefly, I'm an academic. I originally studied economics and politics. I wrote a PhD on regulation of financial services, which I don't think anybody ever read, apart from my examiner. I ended up working in this rather strange field of organisation studies, which is really a kind of part of business or business and management. I ended up being a professor of that at Cambridge University and then Warwick and then Royal Holloway. And a lot of my work, I mentioned the PhD, which was on regulation, and a lot of my work was, as an academic, was sort of on the interface between sort of politics and business, but nothing to do with the EU particularly. And then in terms of the Brexit kind of blog, I mean, what happened with Brexit was that in the run-up to the referendum, I just became aware of the fact that some of the things that were being said, particularly about kind of trade and regulation, were just plain factually wrong. And so I wrote a few little articles, non-academic articles, and I got invited to give various kinds of talks, public talks to people, which they seemed to quite appreciate. And then there was the vote. I was, surprised by the result. I thought it would be a narrow vote to remain, but I did expect it to be narrow, but I thought it would be to remain. So when it got through to the September, I suppose, afterwards, and I came back from summer holiday, and I thought, I just felt as if I would like to have some kind of a voice in that, however small that would be, so I started writing a blog. There's millions of blogs in the world, right? And kind of, and obviously initially nobody read it. I mean, nobody knew it was there, or very few.
I'm familiar with that concept.
Yeah, so you have to sort of, and it wasn't really until I somewhat actually reluctantly to kind of started a Twitter account and the began to sort of publicise it and do other things about Brexit. And then through a series of sort of flukes of people with sort of quite large followerships on Twitter, it began to take off. So that was the background. And, in terms of why it took off, I mean, did you want me to talk about that? Or
Well, perhaps the natural thing to talk about really then is the blog grew and grew for a number of years. Even now that Brexit has actually happened, you've continued it. But more importantly, which had really given rise to this podcast and the reason why we're having a chat today, is that today you have published a book.
Yes.
Which has grown out of the blog. It's not a collection of blogs or anything. It's not an anthology. It's not a collection. As you say in the book, the book would be a lot larger if it was. It's called Brexit Unfolded: How No One Got What They Wanted and Why They Were Never Going to Get It. Congratulations on the book. I have read it. It's got an awful lot in it. I could summarize it, and during this conversation, I probably will. But I thought I'd give you the opportunity at the very beginning, because there is an awful lot in this book, and there's an awful lot that I would consider marvelous stuff in this book. But what would you consider to be, if you're talking to me or a typical reader, and I think I would be, what would be the two or three things that you would want most for us to take away from this?
There's a few things, obviously. I mean, one thing which I try to stress in the book, and actually it's the same in the blog as well, is to try to sort of capture Brexit in all, or at least many, of its many dimensions. And I think that one of the things about Brexit that makes it quite kind of difficult to sort of comprehend is it is so kind of Hydra-headed, and it you know, potentially, I mean, there are a lot of people who have expertise in particular, maybe quite narrow areas of things, perhaps to do with trade or to do with EU law or to do with Northern Ireland politics, or, you know, various kinds of things. And that's fine. But I mean, I think that it's important to sort of try to grasp it in a more holistic kind of way. And I mean by that thinking of it as in terms of politics, in terms of economics, in terms of culture, in terms of a kind of political psychology, which in some ways is quite often talked about in the book. So I think that's one broad and general sort of takeaway that I hope that people would have from it. The other kind of keys kind of takeaway, and I almost thought about this as a subtitle for the book, but in the end it kind of seemed a bit too punchy, was to sort of say that fundamentally you can't turn lies into policy. You can lie in politics, and that's not unusual, but you can't take things that fundamentally aren't true and make them true simply by saying it or simply by believing it. And so you can have all kinds of opinions about Brexit, but what you can't do, for example, as some of the Brexiters tried to do or want to do, you can't say, well, we're not in the single market and the customs union, but we don't need a border. It's not a matter of opinion. You can't say, well, there's two sides to that argument. It's simply it's simply not true. And then more fundamentally, not more fundamentally, but another iteration of that, I suppose, and one of the reasons why I think it was inevitable almost that people would end up not getting what they wanted, is that you can't, all the time the presentation was that Brexit could be or would be cost-free, you know, not just economically, that as well, but you know, in all kinds of ways, that it would be cost-free. And all the way, you know, not just in the referendum campaign, but all of the stuff from David Davis about, oh, well, we can have exact same benefits or we can have frictionless trade, you know, all of those kinds of things. And it's, well, you know, actually, you can't. It's very fundamental. If we're talking about trade, if you put up barriers to trade, then you will do less trade. It's not. This isn't something you can wonder about the extent of it. You know, but the fundamental proposition is there. And so, you know, I think that is a core takeaway. You can't turn lies into policy, whether they're about Brexit or anything else. And then I suppose a third and final kind of takeaway is, and this is more to the kind of the political psychology around Brexit, is that, you know, I think that there's something very problematic, isn't there, about this idea of the kind of self-pitying sense of victimhood that seems to underlie at least one important strand of Brexit. And, you know, you'll know, as I do, the great writing of Fintan O'Toole on this kind of theme. And actually also, I don't know, do you know the Jonathan Coe novel, Middle England?
Have you read it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I kind of feel as if that captures quite nicely in that sort of sense of, you know, even going back before Brexit, this kind of sense of a rather bizarre sense from people who, they were not necessarily talking about, you know, the left behind or anything like that, but people who had this kind of sense of, well, you know, we're put upon, we're bullied, and, you know, all this kind of thing. And again, you know, I'm pinching this from this isn't from my book, although I mentioned it, it's from Fintan O'Toole, but, you know, given that the oppression of being in the EU was imaginary, the liberation was always going to be disappointing.
I think that's a great potential subtitle you mentioned there, that you thought about it but rejected the idea that you can't turn lies into facts. And that raises all sorts of questions immediately in my mind about the psychology of this process, which was something I was going to ask you about in a number of regards, because the psychology of Brexit has, I think, proved endlessly fascinating. And this is one example of what I mean, because you say, by definition, you can't turn lies into facts. You and I will agree that that is demonstrably true, axiomatically true, but it didn't stop them from trying, did it? And if they tried to turn lies into facts, do you think they actually believed the lies themselves? Or do you think that this was just a form of campaigning that they realized was deeply cynical, but nevertheless would work?
You know, I think that's really, you know, fascinating and complex question, isn't it? And of course, it's always impossible to generalize, because, you know, we talk about Brexiters, but they come in so many different, you know, kind of hues. But for what it's worth, you know, as a broad generalization, I don't think that for the most part, it was a conscious process of lying. I think that for many of them, and I'm talking, when I talk about them, I'm not really talking about Leave voters, I'm talking about the leading figures or public figures around the sort of Brexit movement. I think that many of them wanted it to be simple, wanted it to be all these complexities to be imaginary. And and somehow talked themselves into believing that that was so. And of course, in the process, therefore, talking themselves into the belief that if it wasn't so, then it must be because either the EU was being recalcitrant and was punishing them, or because they were being betrayed from the inside by Remainers, or the establishment, all of that kind of thing. And that then becomes very toxic. But I think this idea of, you know, well, it ought to be like that. And one of the reasons I say that, and why I think that diagnosis is correct, is because all the way through the kind of Brexit story, which, by the way, is not at an end, of course. The book ends at the end of the transition period, but we can see playing out all the time now, you know, the ways that wasn't an end. But all the way through the process, you see how they would kind of jump onto, often, I think I use the expression in the book, semi-digested factoids, which were the answer. And it changed at different times, but so sometimes it was the answer was, go WTO, or more narrowly, you know, suddenly there was this point in, I suppose it was it 2019 or it might have been in 2018, where they suddenly latched on to GATT Article 24, which supposedly, this is what they were quite wrong, but they said, oh, well, that means, you know, that we don't need to have a deal and we can just go on trading exactly the same way for 10 years whilst we sort of do a deal. And it was nonsensical, you know, but, it, you know, that's the answer and it was there. And, or similarly, I suppose, they latched on to, you know, do you remember the Carlson report, which was the Brexiters always referred to it as an EU report, but it was actually a report by a consultant to the European Parliament. You know, oh, this was the technological solutions to the Irish border. You know? And so I think that those kind of leading Brexiters persuaded themselves that if only it wasn't for all the EU and the Remainers and so on, there was this thing. I think that was enormously dangerous. Because it was one thing for people to delude themselves. But if you were an ordinary voter listening to that, you know, being said in these very confident, authoritative tones, oh, yes, there's an Article 24 that all we have to do is trigger Article 24 and this will be the thing. You know, and I think you would listen to that and you would think as an ordinary voter, yeah, that's right. And then you would look around and say, well, why isn't Brexit happening? Well, obviously, because these politicians are determined to thwart the will of the people.
I won't dwell on the psychology of this, although endlessly fascinating for me it is. But you talked about the delusion or the semi-delusion of some of these people, but the evolving mindset or the evolution of that delusion took many forms. And the simplest, and I think one of the more famous evolution of that delusion was you can look it up on YouTube, the clip of people like Dan Hannan, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage himself, prior to the referendum, all stating unambiguously that, of course, we're going to stay in the single market. And then somehow or other, and I suspect you're going to start talking about Theresa May's Lancaster House speech at this point, we evolved quite quickly into, we didn't mean it, or implicitly they would say they didn't mean it. It changed. And that was an extraordinary process, wasn't it? Because they were unequivocal during the campaign. There were one or two, but there were virtually none of the leading Brexiteers who said that leaving the single market and the customs union was the way forward.
Well, I would rein back on that, because I mean that YouTube clip is in some ways that you're talking about is in some ways a bit misleading, because for example, and I'm certainly not in the business of defending Nigel Farage, by the way, I will, you know, make that clear as you would expect, but I mean, Nigel Farage in the UKIP position had changed by the time of the referendum campaign. That clip of him predates that time. So UKIP were already saying that. But of course, you're right. Other people like Dan Hannan were certainly talking about, you know, Norway, so which implied the single market. And more than that, the Vote Leave campaign material, and it was said it was both in the material and it was often stated by Michael Gove in particular in various speeches, and they had this very strange formulation, which was there's a free trade zone that stretches from Iceland to Turkey and we will be part of it. Now I think any normal person listening to that anyone who knew about it would think, well, a free trade zone, it's not a free trade zone, it's a single market, these are different things. But the reference to Iceland, you know, seemed to sort of at least imply he was talking about EFTA, you know. And as you say, this, you know, almost from day one, well, sorry, not almost, from day one after the referendum, a lot of the, you know, the kind of the Brexit ultras were immediately saying, having refused to specify a form of Brexit before. They said, oh, it's not for us to do that, it's for the government to do that, you know, if the vote is to leave. They said, no, the vote mandated this hard Brexit, as we called it at the time. And Theresa May came to embrace that. And this is, you know, you just mentioned Lancaster House speech. But of course, what's so interesting about that is that the Lancaster House speech wasn't until January 2017. So if it were true that it was definitionally entailed by the vote to leave, that it meant hard Brexit, well, what were all those months in between all about? What were all those newspaper articles from Dominic Raab and Michael Gove and others in those months urging Theresa May to hard, to hard Brexit? There would have been no urging to be done had it been definitional in the result. And then suddenly, well, some people think it was prefigured by the Tory conference speech in 2016, but it was really in terms said in Lancaster House in 2017. And I can remember that day, you know, and thinking, because until then I had kind of thought, because she'd been very ambiguous, I had kind of thought, look, surely this is, it seems so obvious that this would be, you know, the way to go. In other words, you know, Norway. And I can remember, you know, kind of thinking, oh, you know, almost as much as I did on the day after the referendum, I thought, oh God, these people are seriously going to, you know, F us up.
I think I totally agree with you that Lancaster House was a pivotal moment in the run-up to it. Just take a quick step back, because one of the things that I find interesting in my Anglo-Irish lifestyle that I've had for a number of years is living in Ireland, which is very hard to find a Eurosceptic anywhere. They exist, but they are largely regarded, quite rightly, as a cranky, very tiny minority.
Have you seen Kate Hoey in the Telegraph podcast today?
Not today, no, but I know Kate Hoey's views.
Saying that the logical next step is for Ireland to leave the EU.
And again, sorry to go back to my psychology of delusion. How anybody could A, say it, B, believe it is beyond belief. According to all the evidence is, of course, all of the opinion polls say that Ireland is the most EU enthusiastic country that there is, for all sorts of quite very good reasons. I quite often tease my Irish friends by saying that one of the reasons why you're so enthusiastic, there are lots, but one of them is that it's been made easy for you by the British, that the strain of Euroscepticism that is so prevalent in the UK has enabled you to be, in a way, anti-British by being pro-EU. And people in Ireland get very upset with me when I tease them in that way, particularly senior civil servants. But moving swiftly on, this strain of Euroscepticism in the UK has been around for decades, as you rightly say in the book, and it's been present on the right wing of the Conservative Party, crystallizing, I think, and I think you say this in the book, post-Maastricht, that particular treaty change. But of course, the left, and indeed the extreme left of the Labour Party at the time of EU or EEC accession, as it was back in 1973, were also and have been very anti-European. So it's really quite strange and unique, I think, in Europe, how both the extreme left and the extreme right are united and have been united for decades on this issue. Am I right that it's, and I know the book starts more or less with the referendum I imagine for reasons of space, you don't cover the previous 40 years, but it is an extraordinary thing about British politics, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, the book doesn't even try to explain the referendum result, doesn't discuss the campaign, anything like it starts off. There's a little bit of stuff in the conclusion about the 40 years before that. And it's a huge story. I mean, of course, that's right. I mean, you know, I mean, the opposition to joining what was then the EEC was primarily from the left and from the far left, if you like, at that, and not at all from the right. That's true, but also even at that time from the nationalist right, you know, from the sort of Eloy Powell kind of people, but not the mainstream of the Tory party. And then, as you say, that kind of shifted in the Tory party. I mean, it's a long story in terms of what, you know, the Maastricht debates, you know, very much sort of trigger that. But then the Labour Party, by and large, you know, moved in those years to becoming much more. I mean, in the 1983 election, they had campaigned on the mandate of leaving the EEC. But of course, all that had a strange afterlife, because Jeremy Corbyn, who by the time of Brexit was the Labour leader, had been an acolyte of Tony Benn and had voted with the Maastricht rebels of the Tory Party in the early 90s. I mean, look, because you know, you know as much about that history as I do, and it's a you know, and the whole issue about Britain not wanting to join and then wanting to join and being rebuffed and then joining. And I can't really add to that, but I'm just going to say one thing, which is not in the book, and if you'll forgive me, which is a more personal story in a way, which I think illustrates some of this stuff. And so in 1973, when Britain joined the EEC, I was 8, okay? And I was at junior school, and the headmistress of the junior school, who, I don't know this for a fact, but my feeling would be, you know, was a sort of deeply conservative in her manner, in fact, was very much like Margaret Thatcher, in fact, who at the time was very, you know, of course, pro-EEC. And there was this kind of feeling that we had this pageant about joining Europe, and she composed a song about the wonderful dream of Europe and all of that kind of thing. But that idea, which is extraordinary thinking about it now, you know, but that idea never really took root in Britain, or particularly in England. And one of the reasons for that is that even people who were really quite pro, who were very pro-EU, never really publicly made the case for it. It was always very kind of transactional. There was no sense, even from, say, someone like Tony Blair, who was probably the most pro-EU prime minister since Heath, of, you know, really not just that the EU was worthwhile, but that it was something that Britain was shaping in terms of both the single market and in terms of the East's expansion. But anyway, the personal story, or the other bit of the personal story I want to tell you, is that if I think about my father, dead before the referendum, he would most certainly have voted to leave the EU if he had been alive in 2016. But in 1975, I can remember that referendum, and I can remember him voting in favour. But the reason was that he thought, oh, well, Britain is in such a mess, we can't do anything else, you know. So it was a resentful, grudging sense, almost a sense of being a kind of a humiliation. And his phrase, both at that time, and it was a phrase I heard him use a lot in my childhood, was, and a lot of British people of his generation used, is, oh, we won the war, but we lost the peace. And that after, so I draw two things from that. One is that for people like him, and I'm sure he wasn't alone in this, that vote in 1975, although there was 67% or whatever voted to stay in the EC, it was not a kind of a, it was not in that spirit of my headmistress talking about the wonderful dream. It was in the spirit of, well, we've got to do it.
I think that's very insightful, Chris. And we for reasons of time, it's of course, probably so. A different conversation, but I was 15 in 1973. So I really do remember this.
Yeah.
And having researched it subsequently and taken a strong interest in all of these things for many years, I know that the reason why Britain wanted to join was because of Britain's relative economic decline in the previous post-war years.
Yeah.
And they'd seen the relative economic success that they had made. And as you rightly say, they'd been attempted two joinings and had been turned down by de Gaulle twice, the famous no. It's two quite different things, isn't it? When the EU and the reason why it was put together and why all of those countries, the original six, all that highfalutin stuff about avoiding war and never going to do this fighting over certain things ever again, quite admirable but high-minded reasons for doing it. And then you get... Well, we're joining because we don't want to fall behind. The motivation is you've then got members of the club who have quite different reasons for joining. Yeah. And if those reasons clash, as we subsequently saw, it kind of sort of explains. And I think that where you've just put it there is incredibly insightful. So thank you for that. Why do you think they hate the EU so much?
I'm not sure they do. Well, I suppose it depends who the they is in that.
I've heard Brexiteers say, I really hate the EU.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but they always say, we love Europe, but we hate the EU. And, or even, we're leaving the EU, but we're not leaving Europe. None of these things really make any sense. I mean, what I was going to say is that I think in a lot of cases, even maybe people who say that, I mean, the EU became this kind of blank canvas that they could project all kinds of, you know, often very diverse hatreds or you know, complaints kind of on.
So forgive me for interrupting, yes. That's psychology again, isn't it? Projection, which is a very precise psychological term.
It is a psychological term, but it's not just to do with an individual psychology, is it? Because it's a kind of a cultural psychology. And so I think there's, you know, so you get this kind of different kinds of things of sort of, you know, well, you know, they're taking away our industry and all of this kind of thing. But then there's also something which is to do with, and I think this really came out really horribly in the years after the referendum. A lot of that hatred wasn't so much towards the EU per se, but it was a hatred towards the kind of, as they would say, the metropolitan liberal elite, who were the sort of, you know, the kind of the EU representatives on Earth. You know, so it wasn't so much. Well, we hate the Roman Catholic Church, but we hate the priests. You know, something
yes,
like that.
Indeed.
And so there's that kind of. But I mean, undoubtedly, within all that, there were people who generally did have this hatred for the EU. And I think that, I mean, some of those people are free market liberals who see it as interfering with. I mean, that in itself is a whole other story because I think those free market liberals just simply fail to understand the nature of what global regulation and trade mean. They think they have this naive idea of trade and markets mean the absence of regulation rather than, but that's a whole other story.
Well, it's forgive me, just I think it's an important point that you make in the book and just worth emphasizing it here, is that it's a very 19th century view of trade, isn't it?
Yeah, that's, it really is. And that mattered because it's what led those people to think that they wanted to say, well, we thought we were just joining a free trade bloc, and they thought, well, we can have a free trade agreement which will in some way replicate single market membership, and they didn't understand the fundamental difference between those things, and I would say the core of the fundamental difference, and the reason why it's so important in particular for services, is that what a single market does fundamentally is create a single regulatory space. And it's the abolition, or it's always the sharing of regulations that breaks down the barriers to trade. But as soon as you have shared regulation, then you have to have institutions that both make those regulations and enforce them, which automatically conflicts with the Brexiters' idea of sovereignty. But somehow they kind of thought, well, some of them anyway, I think genuinely thought, that you could replicate a single market in some form of trade agreement, and you could, it was interesting because as it, all we want is a Canada style deal, right? Free trade agreement. That's what they would just say all the time. But whenever Tusk or Barnier said you can have a Canada style deal, it's going to be much less good than your current access. They said, oh, why are they talking about punishing us? Well, they weren't talking about punishing you. They said you can have this Canada style deal. That's what you want. But when it was said by the EU, and the EU was saying, and therefore that means it's not as good as single market, they were saying it's punishment. But just very, very quickly, just to finish, I think there's an interesting sort of strand amongst some of those senior kind of Brexiters that I don't talk about this in the book, but I've seen other people write about it, is that very often they come from these kind of quite strange kind of expat, because British people abroad are not immigrants, right? They're expats. This kind of expat mentality, you know, many of them were kind of, you know, were born in, you know, I don't know, you know, I think Daniel Hannan was born in Peru and you know, they're born in different places, and maybe they were kind of like in boarding schools and have this kind of picture of the United Kingdom. You talk about the 19th century, but actually it's more kind of like a 1950s picture. And you can see this all again with all the current stuff going on about, oh, trade deal with Australia or New Zealand, or very often, or some of the hardcore people, what we want is CANZUC, you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, UK, this kind of thing. And it's like, have these people been to Vancouver or Toronto or Sydney in the last 50 years? They kind of seem to imagine it, these places which are populated effectively by people constantly looking back to the mother country. You know, it's this kind of imagination. And somebody, I think it's some guy that writes under the pen name Otto English, I'm not sure his real name is, talked about this as the kind of, I think, the sort of ladybird picture of, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And for those people, I think they do hate the EU because it's the antithesis.
Yes, I can remember going back to that 1973 decision that a lot of the far less virulent than it is today press focused very much on anchor butter at the time, and which was one of the very few butters that were on sale in the UK, saying,
yes, I remember.
We're not going to have access to anchor butter from Australia anymore.
And of course, it did have the effect, didn't it?
It did, absolutely.
You know, very much disrupting, which is still, I think, felt rather resentfully amongst Australian and
indeed,
Zealand farmers of that generation.
Indeed. In the book, you go through a lot of the ways in which the Brexiteers were factually incorrect, and that's brilliantly documented. But one of the things that you don't do if you don't mind me saying, is that there's not an awful lot of criticism of the EU in the book. Any particular reason for that?
Because the book isn't really meant to be a discussion of the merits or otherwise of being a member of the EU. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of precisely because it starts and takes off from the point of the decision to leave. You know, it's kind of, I didn't want to kind of relitigate those arguments.
And that's, I think that's a very on point answer. But of course, that the reason why I'm asking it is that in that famous old cliche, all great lies have a kernel. Some great lies have a kernel of truth. Do you think that there were any aspects of the Brexiters' arguments that did have a kernel of truth?
I mean, you know, I felt, and this is not me saying it in hindsight, because I know that I wrote it sometime before the referendum, that, you know, there were issues about both the quality and the transparency of democratic process and accountability within the EU. And I think, I mean, I'm not persuaded by that necessarily as an argument for or against Brexit, because you could say the same thing about the political system of the United Kingdom, right? Which is not exactly, but still that. And I think that, I mean, this wouldn't be, I think, necessarily the criticism the Brexiters would make, because it's almost the opposite way around. But I feel as if the EU has pursued an economic project, in particular through the euro, which then moves towards a political project. And I think it should have been the other way around. In other words, you know, in particular in relation to the single currency, I think that the logical and honest way to proceed would be to have political unification as a prelude to single currency. I'm thinking particularly of fiscal policy, because
so you haven't given up being an economist.
No, not entirely, but I think maybe economics gave me up. But of course, you know, having said that, I mean, you know, one of the reasons why that is the case is because countries, probably most influentially the UK, you know, were so determined that the EU would not go down that kind of route. In other words, I suppose what I'm really trying to say is that this is different to the Brexiters, but it's the mirror image, is that I think that the European Union ought to be a super state, and that its failure to become a super state is an important argument. It's an important argument against it, right? Obviously, that's the inverse. And of course, the other thing, which, you know, is I think, and we'll see how it pans out. But I mean, I don't think, for example, that the EU is being nearly robust enough with respect to Hungary or with respect to Poland. You know, so I think, you know, there are those kinds of things as well.
Yes, I think absolutely. The answer I would give to my own question is that there are plenty of things that one can criticise the EU for, but none that amount to a case for leaving it.
And don't you think, you know, because don't you also think that in a way that there's a certain kind of naivety here as well about this? You know, of course, this is like an imperfect institution. You know, are we going to say that the British polity is a perfect institution, that the American constitution, that Ireland, you know, any country that you need? But it's a fantasy to imagine, you know, either it's perfect or we leave it.
Yes, and I'm conscious of your time, Chris, and you can probably imagine that there are so many things in your book that I would love to talk to you about. But one quote amongst lots that leapt off the page at me was the following: Brexit has bequeathed a way of governing which is largely impervious to reason. I think that encapsulates an awful lot. I think it's bang on the money. But what really worries me, Chris, is that is still the case. You're not describing the past, you're describing the Britain that I am living in at the moment. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
I do, you know, and I think that you know, that kind of the Project Fear line that started, you know, with the, well, we've gone back to the Scottish referendum as well, I suppose, but that kind of closed down rational debate, and you see it coming through again in relation to, obviously, the dominant issue has been kind of COVID. Now, that's quite interesting, because you could say that has kind of forced the government to a certain degree of rationality around, you know, but even then you can see how reluctant Boris Johnson has been to make those kinds of decisions about, you know, lockdown and all those kinds of things. And certainly amongst that kind of overlap, as there is between some of the very hardcore Brexiters and the very anti-lockdown people, you can see that kind of irrationality. And then I think also in terms of the way that what Johnson's government has done and what they've taken over from Brexit is this kind of emphasis upon the symbolism of politics in terms of, so, you know, the trade deals or something like that. It's like saying, you know, well, these are a good thing. Why are they a good thing? Well, because we made it ourselves, you know. Well, what does it actually deliver economically? So it doesn't matter, you know. The point about the independent trade policy is it's independent and not, you know. And I think that kind of, I mean, it's important not to be too kind of sort of starry-eyed about this, because, I mean, it's not that we ever had some golden age of political rationality, right? I mean, you know, indeed. You probably would agree with that, I would guess, you know?
Yes.
I don't think that one would necessarily want a politics that was sort of solely kind of rational. But I think that the great dishonesty, and maybe this is a good place to kind of finish with this, the great dishonesty about this, which is also present in the Brexit thing, is that they took something that is that they presented all of this as if it were rational. If you look at those vote leave materials, and videos and so on and so forth before the referendum, you know, actually they're very, very kind of bread and buttery. You know, it's like, well, you know, if we leave the EU, you'll have better access to your GP, you'll have more money for your schools, you'll have more money for your hospitals, you know, there'll be more housing, all of these kinds of things. And it's only later when they kind of said, no, didn't we tell you, you know, you voted to take back control, you know, they don't actually say this, but implicitly they're saying, you know, you're going to have to just sort of suck up the fact, you know, of the economic consequences, you know, because you voted for the, you know, you voted for the freedom, you know. And so that's a kind of irrationality, I think, is permanently kind of, it deforms politics. Not least because of the fact, and this is it's the subtitle of the book, not least because of the fact that it can't deliver what it promises. And ultimately, that evacuates any commitment to the political system at all, because it tells people that whatever they are told, they're not going to get it.
And that speaks to, in part at least, the culture war that Brexit most definitely unleashed. And you talk about that in so many different ways throughout the book. My sense of that culture war is that it's actually getting worse rather than better. And that for me, combined with my sense that quite often when you listen to a political debate in this country now, it's often seen, the most bizarre issues are often seen through leave or remain lens. Or you can predict where somebody stands on a particular issue, depending on whether they were a leaver or a remainer. It seems to have infected, like a pandemic, everything, and that worries me.
And kind of like almost like, you know, I don't want to overdramatize it, but almost like a kind of like a civil war, in as much as there's always now, as you would agree, is that when you meet people for the first time, and people do this, maybe not quite so much now as immediately after, but do this little kind of dance, a verbal dance, to try to work out what, you know, where people stand, or where they, you know, or where they stood, and it's been awful in that way. I just want to say, because I know that we're going to close, but I know that you have a lot of listeners in Ireland, and one of the things that I wanted to say, and I know my blog gets read in quite a bit in Ireland as well. One reason for that, I think, is that for a lot of people, not just in Ireland but across the EU, they want to have some kind of handle on, you know, what the hell has happened to the Brits? Why are they gone so mad? And but what I really wanted to say was that, from my point of view, the quality of Irish journalism and Irish academic comment in particular, and indeed Irish statecraft in terms of Brexit, has been just hugely impressive. You know, and I mean, I could, you knew even more with your own, not least in your own writing, but, you know, thinking of people like Tony Connolly and Fintan O'Toole, who we mentioned earlier, and many, many people. And I think that's been, you know, that's just been extraordinary, and the quality of that coverage and commentary on Brexit, you know, has been so refreshing compared with that of the United Kingdom, and of course much more extensive than it has been in other EU countries, for obvious reasons. You know, so I mean, there are interesting things written in I read the French press quite a lot, and I read the German press to an extent, and so on and so forth. But there hasn't been nearly the same attention there. So, and imagining that amongst your listeners, maybe some of those some of those, indeed, some of those writers and journalists and politicians, I would like to say that.
Thank you, Chris. And I think that that's probably a good point to end this discussion, although I think certainly I would love to continue it for much longer. But to commend to all of our listeners this book that Chris Gray has written, Brexit Unfolded. It is published today. It comes with a wholehearted recommendation from me, at least. It contained much that I had forgotten and much that I didn't know. And it really is a must read for anybody trying to get a handle on what Britain has gone through over the last few years and probably is going to go through over the next few years. So a big, big thank you to Chris for writing the book and a big thank you for speaking to me on this podcast today. Many, many thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. That was very interesting.
You have been listening to Chris Johns and Jim Power on The Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please sign up to our Substack account, www.cjpeconomics.substack.com. You can download our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, and other good podcast platforms.